Welcome to the IBCLC Mentor Podcast, where real-world lactation cases and theoretical scenarios come to life. I'm Margaret Salty, your host, and a dedicated IBCLC with passion for guiding the next generation of lactation consultants. Whether you're a student or new to the field, this podcast is designed to equip you with the knowledge and confidence you need to excel in your practice. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the IBCLC Mentor Podcast. I'm Margaret Salty, your host, and today we are talking with Megan McCleskey. She is one of my former students. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us where you're located and where you're currently working.
I am located in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. And I'm currently working at multiple hospitals and building a private practice. So one of the hospitals I work at, you're basically a contracted in specialist, just like a physician would be. And you get a patient list for the day that's usually divided up between you and several LCs. And we are the ones that see every single patient that's either postpartum or even postpartum readmit, or if there's a lactation referral from any physician throughout the hospital. But obviously, primarily, we're in labor and delivery and postpartum. And so that looks a little different just because of the way you're coming in. And like, I might be an hourly employee, but they bill through the insurance. At my other hospital, I'm actually an employee there. So when I clock in, but this same similar concept, I mean, I still see every single patient at that hospital, ideally, when I come into work and I work my shift.
Awesome. How many patients do you feel like you see on a shift?
On average, anywhere from 12 to 20 in a 12-hour shift.
So I want you to start by telling me, what is it that made you pursue a career in lactation?
Well, my journey kind of started a little over a decade ago when I had a baby, and she was full term technically, but she was really tiny. She was 4 pounds, 9 ounces. Took her home like everything was normal, and like most of us know, she of course struggled to breastfeed, but I didn't know that. But she kind of behaved like the great imposter, the late preterm little person. And so I struggled with breastfeeding and weight gain, and I didn't really have a pediatrician that was supportive of breastfeeding, just wanted to make sure the baby was well and taken care of without finding that middle ground. And so I just trust the process. And of course, she then got bottles to supplement and frustrated at the breast. So we didn't last very long, maybe 4 or 6 months at the most. And then I had another baby 5 years later. And I all of a sudden I had a very similar problem, but an even bigger baby, but it was an actual late preterm a month early. And that this time I got help from an IBCLC locally. Awesome. And lots of empowerment, lots of encouragement. And I'd always really been passionate about breastfeeding, even from the first time, but I'd never really met anyone that had any problems. I was the only one. And so I just kind of felt like, what's wrong with me? And then I got that support and I realized there isn't anything wrong with me. And it kind of just sparked a fire for me to get involved with birth work and support. And so that's kind of, energized my late in life career change.
I love that. I think that a lot of us that come to lactation are coming with some kind of experience and passion, and we want to help other mothers in our same situation. So I'm sure that you are such a support, especially for those moms with late preterms and babies that are just having a really rough time. So that's awesome. All right. So there's lots of different pathways to get to the lactation career. Tell me about yours.
I did pathway 2, and it was a long, drawn-out decision for me. I actually looked at them kind of years before and shelved it. I wasn't sure if I could do it and cost time and all the pieces. And I was really distracted and kind of deterred from pathway 1 when I looked at all of them, and pathway 3 because I needed to support my children and continue to work. I didn't know how I would do all the things and still eat. And so I shelved it several times for several years and then came back looking again and saw that UC San Diego had the Pathway 2 program. And I was excited because they had the simulations and I would be able to do it in the evening and still have a job. And so I was super excited, and I applied and got accepted and I got approved, and literally it's been history ever since.
Amazing. So what was your career before you changed careers?
So I've had two sort of, I had a undergraduate degree in government. So I went into the criminal justice kind of social work world. I was an adult probation officer, and I've worked with youth advocacy. And then that kind of transitioned me into criminal defense, which I did mostly for the last 10 years. And I managed a criminal defense practice. I also sprinkled in some special education teaching in there. So I've done that for several years also.
Amazing. So did you have a lot on the prerequisite list that you had to get done before you could enroll in the Pathway 2 program?
Yeah, I had every single one of the prerequisites that I had to do. I think I only had one undergraduate course that could have possibly taken statistics, but that course isn't offered anymore. I actually went into the depths of my university trying to get a syllabus from over 10 years ago, and I wasn't successful. So I just bit the bullet and took statistics again.
Good. You made it. You know, my favorite thing is talking about cases. Any cases you want to talk about?
So something that I have noticed in the hospital that I didn't know that being in the hospital would teach me so much that I thought I knew, or that I now have a giant respect for hospital IBCLCs, because they have a limited amount of time to triage situations. And so it's made me a better clinician. At the same time, I see things that I'm starting to struggle with, or that I don't know how to, maybe that I don't know how to work with in a short period of time, which is when we have babies that back up from the breast, just constantly unlatch. They can sustain a latch, like they, in regards to they can put the breast tissue in their mouth, they can get a wide enough gape, but they will just continuously unattach from the breast. And, but they're rooting for it immediately afterward, and they want to reattach, but they will not sustain the latch for long periods, which is overwhelming for parents. And the baby is then starts to get irritable, and it's kind of like a cycle that, in a lot of times, I you know, go through the tricks of the trade, I would say, you know, where I'm thinking about chin support, positioning, looking at oral anatomy. And when I'm not seeing where I'm trying those things and I'm not getting anywhere, what do I do next?
Yeah, definitely. I think that we have to like consider if the baby can latch on and suck and sustain the latch and then is pulling off, there's probably something going on in that baby's mouth that is causing them pain. My first thought is when the baby is delivered, if you're in a delivery and you watch a delivery, they're pretty wild with the bulb syringe, and damage can happen even if we can't really see it. You know, they're cramming that thing in there quickly and kind of deep. And even though it is a soft rubber, it can still be damaging to that baby's mucosal structures inside their mouth. So maybe that baby got kind of jabbed with the bulb syringe, and the baby really wants to nurse and knows it should nurse. But once it gets on the breast, it's kind of like, oh, that hurts. That hurts. That can happen. Deep suctioning can cause the baby to have a little bit of a sore throat too. So if there's MAC at the delivery, or if it just happens to be a provider that really likes to delee every kid or really do some deep suctioning, that can irritate the baby's throat. So they may be willing to latch onto the breast, but then once they start sucking, if they have some pain there, they're coming off. The other thing that I think that could be even a more simple explanation is if the baby still has some fluid once they get to the breast, especially if they're kind of in the laid back position, if they start to try to suck and swallow and breathe with their head down on the breast, their nose may get occluded. And babies are obligate nose breathers, so they kind of like wig out if they can't breathe, which is a good thing. But so that may be part of what's happening too, if something like that.
I've definitely said that, because that's when I'm looking at it. I try to remind the parents all the time that they know how to suck, swallow, and breathe, but learning how to do all of them at the same time while breastfeeding, it takes a little bit, you know, of time to kind of get. Well, I jokingly say that it's, you know, have you, the first time you rode a bike, you were really wobbly, or someone held the back end, and even when they let go, you weren't all that great. So let's give the time for the baby to figure out what it needs to do. But in the hospital setting, what I see so often is that they get so worked up, they get so stressed out when the baby doesn't eat, or, you know, they worry that the baby's going to starve. Most of the time I see this irritability when that happens is within the first 24 hours. And I don't tend to worry, but I hate walking away from the parent who, no matter how much I've reassured them that this is normal and let's give it a little bit of time. Sometimes I even think about, like you were saying, like what happens in birth, but even just what they just came out of the birth canal, and or they've been in the womb for so long, you know, they're kind of shoulders up by their mouth and they don't have the wiggle room, and they kind of need to just, their muscles need to relax so that they can sustain. They're a little sore, and sometimes we just have to work through it, but people want that immediate, you know, satisfaction and lack of concern. So I'm trying to find that middle ground of making them happy, but knowing that it may take a little time.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to convince parents that it's okay to just wait. I mean, some parents, especially multips, know that, and they're a little bit more chill about it. But a lot of first-time parents, especially if they didn't take a breastfeeding class, or they don't have a lot of breastfeeding self-efficacy at this point, they're really quick to be like, well, if he's not feeding, maybe we need to give him something else. Maybe we need to give him formula, something like this. So I think, you know, a really good solution is to try to teach people to hand express, show them, even if the baby just gets drops, that's huge, because the colostrum is so concentrated that even just few drops is going to really be beneficial to the baby. But as you and I both know, sometimes it's really hard to hand express a first time mom if she's never done it before. She's got some edema, like it's frustrating. It can be really frustrating. And that's why I think teaching moms antenatal hand expression is huge. I mean, I would love to do a study at some point on breastfeeding self-efficacy and doing antenatal hand expression and see if there is a correlation there, because I hypothesize that there definitely is one. I mean, I see it in my moms that do antenatal hand expression in the hospital when their baby isn't able to latch or isn't cooperating. They already know how to do it. If we ask them to do it, they're like, oh yeah, I've done this before. I know how to do this. And they can sort of troubleshoot and kind of overcome those difficulties a little bit better than a mom that's like never even really touched a breast like that.
I see it a lot. And several of the hospitals that I worked in, the population from where they originate and culturally, that there's a large misconception that there's a lack of milk because, you know, they haven't seen it leaking out, you know, while pregnant. And so I do a lot. I feel like I spend more time educating when I'm in the patient's room than I actually do any sort of, you know, I do tons of latching assistance, but I do feel like I educate predominantly the entire time during the consult.
100%. I mean, we wear so many hats as an IBCLC. I think that's one of the biggest revelations for students is we wear a lot of different hats. We're a counselor, we're an educator, you know, all the things that we do. Have you found any tricks or anything that's really helped you apart from maybe hand expressing to help these babies latch successfully?
So sometimes it is the chin support, which sounds, it's always something that I've had this struggle with logically, that how does pulling the chin up make them stay? The science behind it never works in my brain, but I've trusted the process. Well, and you know, limited resources in the hospital, but you know, sometimes rolling up a washcloth, which those aren't always readily handily for me, because sometimes my moms haven't taken a shower yet, so they haven't brought them those resources. So I find something, but I thought about it as using as a chin support, a beauty blender. And the reason I say that is so funny because it's squishy but supportive at the same time, and it can still maintain under, but obviously I talk about a risk, choking risk factor, things like that, but almost like the bigger ones. But that was the concept that I sort of kind of thought about, because you can't always get the washcloth rolled the right way or tucked up under the chin in a way. So, but chin support has been the biggest thing. And honestly, like you said, hand expression, that is something that I'm super passionate about. I didn't think I was until I was in hospital care. And now I am like a super, super passionate about it and talking about it, but also making sure that I tell them about a realistic expectation of output so that they're not getting, that it doesn't perpetuate the thought of no milk. And then the biggest thing that I will say is really putting the baby back skin to skin and asking them to be patient and to trust the process and that I'm there to support them.
Yes, definitely. Skin to skin is magic. I tell students all the time on the exam, if skin to skin is an option, that's the answer. It's magic. Put the baby skin to skin and just wait. It'll come around. I mean, the chin support thing does make sense to me. If a baby is really having a hard time kind of like finding their center in the breast and they're kind of moving around like that, even if it's a textbook perfect nipple, fits perfectly in the mouth, if the kid is like moving around and can't find their center, sometimes just giving that chin support helps them just to close down and find what they're looking for.
Yes.
I mean, we know that chin support can work well with a bottle for babies that are kind of all over the place and can't figure out what to do. That's generally a much smaller nipple, so it makes sense that the baby's a little bit all over the place, but babies have lots of challenges. And a lot of times I think the general medical model wants to pretend like the epidurals aren't really going to affect the baby. And we definitely know that they do. So we have to kind of consider all the things leading up to this. Yes, your baby was really alert and maybe nursed great that first time, but now they're like recovering from all that. And now they're like waking up and trying to figure out what their baseline is. And we have to get rid of all those epidural medications. And they probably have some pain in their neck or their shoulders from that delivery process. Whether or not it was a C-section or a vaginal delivery, they're going to have pain. So we really have to take into consideration all those things. And it would be really helpful if moms were educated about that in prenatal classes, but they're not. So they don't know that their babies are probably in some pain as well.
Well, and I think that just knowing the whole picture, that people need to understand what that normal newborn behavior, what those are, and then what other things do impact those, like you said, like epidural medications or just birth trauma or whatnot. But I feel like I talk about that 500 times a day. I say it like 10 times in every consult, because I really want them to understand that if I'm not worried and the you know, multidisciplinary team isn't worried, I need you not to worry too.
Yeah. I like to tell my patients, this is when we worry. All these things that are happening right now are normal, but we aren't going to worry until this point. And you got a long way until we get to that. So don't worry. If you need my help, you just call me.
I'm the same way. I stress to them, call me at any point in time. If I'm in the middle of another mm-hmm. consult, I may not be able to run there, but put the baby skin to skin or do your best until I show up. I think that those, especially those first time ones with those nervous moms that maybe had a traumatic first go around that it wasn't successful. And I kind of, that's maybe where my heart is, because I'm like, no, we can do this. And I want you to learn to trust your body.
Yes, definitely. Love that. I would love to know what advice you would give to somebody considering becoming an IVCLC.
I would tell them that Pathway 2 is invaluable. I learned in the concept of the simulation versus, you know, having an in-person preceptor. I think there's pros and cons to both, but I will tell you that the in-person stuff you could mix in or kind of learn a little bit, like that is pretty invaluable. What I learned, that situations that I wouldn't know to experience in person if I haven't ever experienced it, at least I've been exposed to it. And so I would say that that's the best thing. And also, don't be afraid to piecemeal your prerequisites from universities or institutions all around just to get them done. And so that you, in a, you know, time frame that's effective for your family, because that's what I had to do and to make it happen.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to just piggyback a little bit on what you're saying in case nobody understands. So at least the Pathway 2 program that you did, it's really designed, the simulation piece of it is really designed to kind of show you the breadth of cases that you could potentially see as a lactation consultant, many of which you may never actually see if you were to work in person with someone. So if you're doing an internship with an IBCLC in a hospital, you really are only seeing newborns and maybe a 2-week follow-up or something like that, but mostly just what happens in those first 48 hours. And that's kind of it. If you work with a private practice person, you may see more things, but we, you know, the Pathway 2 program simulation is really designed to show you cases that you may never have even considered that you would experience, but you want to have the knowledge and the skills to be able to even process it if you were to encounter those in your work. So I think that it really turns out high quality IBCLCs or IBCLC candidates, I should say. And I think you are educated in such a well-rounded way that I think that everybody that's coming out of that is really high quality and going to do really amazing work. For the prerequisites, did you do any of the things from Sophia? I hear a lot of students that use that, and I'm wondering what the success rate is with that.
So I looked into it, and I know that technically I went back, and I'm, you know, worked in the legal field, so I really look at the fine print of what the requirements of things are. And when it said, like, I think, and I'm going off memory just a little bit, it was like ACE certification or something like that. And I don't know if it was when I did it or if I was just like, this just seems so sketchy and you won't know until you apply for the, you know, exam. And I just something about it didn't sit right with me. But I also, to be honest, was thinking about future pieces of like if I ever wanted to expand my skill set, like midwifery or something like that. And I was like, I don't want to take a 2-week course and not know anything, but just to say I did it. But more importantly, I just didn't feel like it was college transfer acceptable is the way that I saw it. I even called a local community college and they're like, we don't take courses from them. And so I just thought about it. I was like, that's not what I want to do. So I took everything through either a local junior college, community college at, or some universities. I had to piecemeal all of the stuff together.
How long did it take you to do your prereqs?
So some of those can double, you know, when you can do like human biology can count from one. So I ended up those prerequisites out of the top 8, I actually only had to do 5 because the way that I pieced them together, but I did literally without any breaks from January to July. And I think I did out of those 5 courses, I think they were like 5 different institutions. So learning their login process and how to do all that online was, it was quite the adventure. And some of them were summer courses. So those are really fast paced. I even did one that was like a Maymester. So it was a lot of information.
I love that though. Decide to do it and just put your whole self into it and then
get
it done.
Right.
Love it. All right. Well, this was awesome. I think that new lactation consultants, students, people that are just curious can learn a lot from that. I think that we could talk for days about working in the hospital and the limitations that you have, but it sounds like you're doing amazing work. So I'm very proud of you, Megan. And I am looking forward to hearing more about what happens with your private practice. We will share the link for that below so they can check out everything that you are doing. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Be sure to like, follow, and subscribe, and check me out on social media at Margaret Salty.